Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, thanks a lot. Y'all ready to sleep? We're trying to figure out something to play, but we only know about 6 phones right now. 7, 9. We're going to do the Praetorium, the Black Panthers national anthem.
Black Legacy series with Corey Washington. Before we get started, just a little intro for our guests today. We have Baba Sila out of Brooklyn, New York, who describes himself as a hipster, bohemian, husband, father, grandfather, singer, musician, writer, actor, social activist, and probably whatever else he wants to do. He's not afraid to take the road less traveled. It's great to have you with us, Baba. Are you there?
Thank you. Yes, I am.
Okay. Now, were you able to hear the intro that I played of Jimi Hendrix and the Band of Gypsies?
Oh, did I?
And it was of particular interest of his intro where he mentioned the Black Panthers national anthem. And I know that you were privileged to have been on a very pivotal scene back in the 60s in New York, especially with the Black Panthers and Jimi Hendrix. But before we get into that, just tell us a little something about yourself.
Well, I live in Brooklyn. I am a musician. I play bass, and I play percussion, primarily percussion these days, and I'm a vocalist. And for my day job, I'm the supervisor at the Kings County Clerk's House, the Kings County Clerk's Office. We hold the records for the Brooklyn Supreme Court.
Okay. Now, back into our topic, what was the cultural musical climate like when you were growing up, and how did Jimi Hendrix fit into all of that?
Well, wow, how do I start? The first thing I'd like to do is tell a little story about the first time I saw Jimi Hendrix. And it was this Sunday, 1966. my parents, my friend and I, Greg Sims, wanted to go out that night. We were 14 years old. We just got our Easter suits and brand new shoes and whatnot, and we wanted to do something. So we decided to head out to the village. We'd never been to the village before, you know. But we'd heard about it. We walked around and got to Bleeker. We got to McDougal Street between Bleeker and 3rd Street, and we came upon this interesting place. Looked interesting from the inside. It was called Cafe Wa. So we went inside Cafe Wa, and there we saw this this group called Jimmy James and the something or other. I forget what the name was, but it wasn't Jimi Hendrix. He was calling himself Jimmy James.
Jimmy James and the Blue Flames?
That's what it sounds like, yeah. Jimmy James and the Blue Flames. So we went in, and they didn't serve any alcohol then. And, you know, we had a couple of ice cream sodas. And we waited for the act to come on, and these four guys came on. And the lead singer, guitarist, was this madman. I mean, I never seen anything like it before in my life. This guy sang. He played the guitar between his legs, behind his back. He played it with his teeth. And he just cut a fool out there on that stage. And we were just mesmerized, you know. And that was my introduction to Jimi Hendrix. Now, after that, we left and we went to a discotheque called the Cheetah, which was on Broadway and 52nd Street. And we met some girls there, and we had a good time with them, and we got on the subway, and we went to them the 42nd Street, and then they went their way, we went our ways, and that was the end of that day. But we had a great time that night, and that was my introduction to Jimi Hendrix.
Wow. So man, you got a chance to look at him at his early stages, or one of his early stages.
Yeah, it's very early stage. About a year later, I was in one of my first bands of my own. It was a band called the Magic People. We were a bunch of high school kids, and I was living in the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn at the time, and I was going to high school in Bensonhurst, which was a primarily white area, and I was playing rock with these guys, and I looked down and they had this album, and it was Jimi Hendrix's first album, All You Experienced. And on it was a song that I heard Jimmy play at Cafe Wa, Hey Joe. But Hey Joe on the album was very slow. In the club, he played it extremely fast. He played it blisteringly fast. And I never heard Hey Joe played in that manner again. You know, but it was just fantastic. Now, you talk about what the musical thing was at that time. I was getting into rock. And when I say rock, I'm talking about progressive rock. But most black folks were in the R&B, you know, most black folks were into James Brown. They were into Wilson Pickett. They were into Sam and Dave. They were into the Temptations, the Motown groups, the Stax groups and whatnot, you know, And there was a dichotomy between black music and white music. Jimi Hendrix was considered to be one of those guys who played white music, and there weren't too many black folks playing white music. The only person who was like straddling the line was Sly and the Family Stone, you know, because he had an integrated group and he had put elements of rock into his music, but for the most part, Jimmy was alone.
Okay. Now, a lot of the bios that I read on Jimmy, most of them, they seem to go out of their way to distance Jimmy from the Black Panthers. They always use selective quotes, maybe ask the wrong people that have never had any knowledge of Jimmy's dealings with the Panthers. From your point of view, what's your take on Jimmy's connection to the Black Panthers?
Well, now I got another short story to tell you. A few years later, this is 1968. I went to the village to look for the beatniks. I had heard about the beatniks all my life, you know, and I thought they were an interesting group. I remembered Maynard G. Krebs and all those cats, and you know, I thought it would be cool to like mix in with those guys. So I went to Greenwich Village to Washington Square Park, and no beatniks. Not only were there no beatniks, there was no scene there. It was just a regular park scene with folks playing frisbees and stuff like that there. So they told me to go to the East Village, to Tompkins Square Park. So I walked down 8th Street, and 8th Street turned into St. Mark's Place, and St. Mark's Place went right into Tompkins Square Park, and there was a totally different scene. I never met the beatniks. The beatniks had turned into the hippies. All these folks with long hair and bell bottoms and beads and flamboyant shirts and folks walking around on the sidewalk barefooted and all that stuff. And one of the things that was kind of prevalent at the time was that the marijuana culture. There would be these circles of people sitting around smoking marijuana, and anybody could join the circle. You could just walk up, sit down, and someone would pass you a joint or joints, as it were. Well, sitting in this particular circle was Abby Hoffman, who was a lefty political leader. He was involved with a group called Students for a Democratic Society, which later became the Weathermen. His partner, Jerry Rubin, who was also there, and Jimi Hendrix. And they were sitting around smoking weed with everybody else. Now, what was interesting about Tompkins Square Park is that you had a lot of folks who were down there just hanging out, you know, because I used to go down there and hang out all the time. The Chambers Brothers used to come out and hang out in Tompkins Square Park. A group called the Fugs used to come out and hang out in Tompkins Square Park. And after a while, I did meet some beatniks then who turned out to be hippies. Allen Ginsberg, guys like that, you know, and the Panthers were down there, and they were doing their recruitment thing. They were trying to recruit people, you know, so they were down there handing out their paper and handing out literature and whatnot. And the conversation that was in the circle turned around what was going on politically. The war in Vietnam, the civil rights demonstrations that were going on at the time. And Jimmy got into a conversation with some of the Panthers that were there. And the Panthers were saying that they dug Jimmy's music. And Jimmy was saying that, well, he dug the Panthers. And there was some talk right then and there, kind of impromptu, about, you know, Jimmy doing stuff with the Panthers, you know. Jimmy said he might have been interested. And that's the kind of stuff that I heard that day. Now, what was also happening with me that day was that, I mean, at that time was, I was about 16. I was also involved in a works program called Neighborhood Youth Corps. And Neighborhood Youth Corps, the program that I was in was run by Bed-Stuy Youth in Action, and they met on the campus of Pratt Institute. And at Pratt Institute, they had a program called Campaign Culture, and I was a part of that campaign. I was they actually paid us $38.50 a week to take classes in whatever we were interested in. I was interested in music and theater, so I was fortunate enough to get into a theater workshop, which was run by the teacher was Joe Morton, who's famous for being the father on the Scandal series right now. And I also took bass violin lessons, first from Bill Lee, Spike Lee's father, and then from Ahmed Abdul Malik, who was Thelonious Monk's bassist. And the Panthers were around the campus at the time, too. And due to their influence, I joined the Black Panther Party. And I was involved with their breakfast programs, and I would go there in the mornings, in the afternoons after things were finished at Campaign Culture, and, you know, interact with them. They had their office on Fulton Street in Bed-Stuy at the time, and they were doing their breakfast program out of a church, which was down the block from them. And I got to see the Black Panthers in terms of what their musical thing was, and they were very open. You know, this was the New York Panthers, the Brooklyn Panthers, but they were very much influenced by what was going on the West Coast and Oakland, and they were influenced by, again, Sly and the Family Stone and Jimi Hendrix and whatnot. And there was talk in the office about things going on between the Panthers and Jimi Hendrix. From what I stand, Jimi Hendrix wasn't satisfied with the fact that he was just being accepted by the wider ones, audiences. He wanted to expand his base to include Black folks. And when the Jimi Hendrix Experience started breaking up, he hooked up with his Army buddy, Billy Cox, and with Buddy Miles, and they formed the Band of Gypsies. And as you can see, they got into more of a funkier orientation than what was going on with the Experience. And it was Jimmy's way of trying to make inroads into getting popular with the Black community.
Okay. Now, when the Band of Gypsies broke up, do you remember any kind of discussion with the Panthers or in the neighborhood that you were in, and any kind of disappointment expressed, or maybe, you know, what may have happened, why they broke up?
No. There was some other stuff going on with the Panthers at the time.
Okay.
The Panthers were going through their own internal stuff politically. They had gone from basically being a grassroots group that were against police brutality and wanted to bring social programs into the Black community, to an organization that was taking a leaning towards Marxist-Leninism. They started giving out Mao's Little Red Book. They started talking about something called dialectics, which I didn't understand at all. And there was this paranoia that was going on through the Panthers. They thought that there were informants, FBI informants, under every bedpost. And they started acting that way, and they started getting very, very closed. And there was a breakup between the, first of all, the New York Panthers and the California Panthers. And there was also a kind of breakup between the Brooklyn Panthers and the Harlem Panthers. So things were kind of getting disintegrated, and there was less emphasis being done on cultural things and more on survival.
Okay. Now, when it comes to Jimi Hendrix, I just want to put this to you. I'm not sure how many Jimi Hendrix bios you've read, but I've read tons of them, and I know all the nuances that they like to put. Most of them are not written from people, from our perspective, people of color. They like to – well, let me ask you this. Why do you think that a European or a white American writers go out of their way – to try to distance Jimmy from the Black Panthers or paint a picture of him as, you know, kind of being lackluster or lukewarm towards them, and they don't really want to seek the truth? And why do you think they want to put that image out there of Jimmy, you know, as the way that they see it? Why do you think they want to project that about Jimi Hendrix?
Honestly, I have no idea. I know that Jimi Hendrix was looked upon as an exotic. He was looked upon as an anomaly. You know, here's this Black man playing rock music, which they didn't, which they thought of as a white art form, even though Black, let's be frank about it, Black people created rock music. We created rock and roll. You know, white music took what they, white people took what they heard and adapted it to the way that they could deal with it, you know. But all music, all popular music that you hear in America is blues based. And Jimi Hendrix was deeply into the blues, but he played an electric blues that Muddy Waters couldn't have even conceived of. You know, this guy was on another trip. Again, in answer to your question, why would they want to separate Jimmy from the Black Panthers? I honestly have no idea.
Now let's go into Jimmy's his FBI files. Jimmy was not only associated with the Black Panthers, but with also other subversive groups. He did concerts and supported them and so forth. Have you ever heard anything about his F-files or anything in connection with that?
You know, the first time that I heard of any kind of FBI files was, frankly, in... I kind of did some peripheral research prior to doing this interview because I wanted to get my time frames right and things like that there. And the first time that I ever heard of any kind of FBI or COINTELPRO connection to Jimi Hendrix was reading the stuff that I read online immediately before doing this interview.
I was able to acquire the actual files that's heavily redacted, and you could barely make out, you know, but from what I've read, it seems that he was being followed kind of like Malcolm X was and so many others, and you kind of alluded to it already that a lot of
suspicion, you know, sunk in, and now we know after everything has come out about the COINTELPRO and how they were targeting people. But I just didn't know whether you had any inside knowledge on that, if the Panthers were kind of already outing people back then about who they suspected might be, you know, infiltrators.
From what I saw, the Panthers got absolutely paranoid. They got to the point where they thought everybody was an infiltrator. They didn't trust anybody, and with good reason. Panthers were getting off all over the place. And I have to point something else, too. There was another movement that was going on at the same time, and that was an African nationalist movement, a black movement, black nationalist movement. And you had also the Nation of Islam going on. And these are like three separate streams. In addition, you also had the old line civil rights groups as well. And COINTELPRO was targeting all of these groups, including white groups like the Weather Underground, the Students for a Democratic Society, people who
white
were dealing
Panthers.
With White Panthers. I hadn't heard of the White Panthers. Okay, I know that the Black Panthers had relationships with Students for a Democratic Society, which became the Weather Underground, and also a Puerto Rican group called the Young Lords, which we visited up in East Harlem. But the White Panthers, I hadn't heard of.
Okay.
Getting back to the African nationalist thing, most of the African nationalist groups, which were following the line of Marlena Ron Karenga of the US group in on the East Coast and of what's his African name? Amiri Baraka on the East Coast. Most of them were talking about not dealing with white people, okay? Separating from white people, dealing with building black institutions that were not mixing with white people. The Black Panthers were not like that. The Black Panthers mixed with anybody who they considered was an ally. So there was a kind of a tension between these groups. Okay, and the Nation of Islam was going through their own thing. For example, a lot of the African nationalists were followers of Malcolm X. Well, there was a schism between the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X, and Malcolm X had been assassinated. So to show you how the schism was, I once went to a Steak and Take, which was located in Brooklyn in Bed-Stuy, walked into the Steak and Take wearing a Malcolm button, and the brothers in the Steak and Take wouldn't serve me.
Mm.
That's how critical it was. You wearing that Malcolm X button, we won't serve you, okay? You got to take that button off, brother. You know, so there were these lines of dichotomy that was going on within the black community.
To kind of switch gears slightly, true or false statement I want to put to you, Jimi Hendrix was not well received in the black community during his career from 1967 to 70, true or false? Or is that a loaded statement?
I would think that is pretty much true. However, I found out that what I found was that after the 70s, people started getting hip to Jimmy. And it's funny, you know, in terms of music, people think that New York is the happening place. Everything hits New York first, but it doesn't. You know, as far as black music was concerned, it would always hit down south and then filter up to the north. Okay? So when I went down south on a Christmas vacation in 1970, I started seeing black bands playing Jimi Hendrix influence type of rock. I mean, Jimi Hendrix guitar kind of stuff. And that wasn't happening in the North. Now, I think that this influence primarily came through Parliament Funkadelic, okay, which at that point was you had Parliament and you had Funkadelic, you know, and it was kind of an insider thing, but these barriers slowly started melting. And
okay, I think we might have gotten some technical difficulties here. Let me go ahead and play this track called Straight Ahead, and I want you to listen to the lyrics. Was Jimi Hendrix's song Straight Ahead, which was heard later on after his death, but he also played it in concert a few times. And I just wanted you to zero in on the lyrics of that song. First of all, he was saying straight ahead, which was used by a lot of civil rights groups back at that time. Then toward the end, he was saying power to the people, which was another rallying cry of the Black Panthers and other black groups. Power to the people, freedom of the soul, pass it on to the young and old. And then he was talking about you got to teach the children the truth. They don't need a whole lot of lies because one of these days, they'll be running things. So when you give them love, you got to give it right or something like that. I'm trying to paraphrase him. But just his lyrics back then was starting to change toward the 70s. Baba, are you there with us? We might have lost Baba. I don't know if he can hear us, but I had wanted him to comment on that song. So what we're going to do now is I want you to listen to Jimi Hendrix talking about the national anthem, which we know is a controversial topic right now with Colin Kaepernick of the San Francisco 49ers. And I just want you to have that in your mind as I play this clip of Jimi Hendrix at the L.A. Forum before he gets into his national anthem that he played so famously at Woodstock.
Here's a song that we was all brainwashed with. Remember this song is what good is?
National anthem kind of took a turn there. By that time, it was 1970, and he saw what was going on around him and kind of went from there. And you can hear how his playing kind of, you know, you can hear him, you know, here's a song that we was all brainwashed with, you know, and then he plays the national anthem and then he didn't put all the fireworks into it like he did at Woodstock, but at some point you can kind of hear him mumble BS, you know, it's kind of like, what Colin Kaepernick is saying about the national anthem. You know, here it is, this country, you know, these words, flowery words of
freedom and, you know, equality and this and that. But that's not what was going on. That's not what he saw. And so you just have to open up your eyes and realize that Jimi Hendrix was a very complex individual. He's not what they make him out to be, as this utopian, you know, he wasn't into politics. He didn't see this or he didn't see that. He didn't see race. While it is true that Jimi Hendrix was for all people, all races, he wanted to bring all races together. That's not what the government really wanted at that time. That's not really what was their agenda. They were into the conquer and divide type thing. So therefore, Jimi Hendrix and his way of thinking of bringing everybody together was at odds with them. And we kind of saw what happened to people that were at odds with the government, especially concerning Vietnam, which MLK, toward the end of his life, was very vocal about, which he didn't live very long. So all I'm trying to say is take a closer look at Jimi Hendrix and a well-rounded picture of him. Look at this thing from all angles. We were very privileged to have Baba with us, who was able to shed some light on the inner workings of the Panthers and the whole scene. And he even got a chance to see Jimmy in 1966, which is a rare privilege. So we want to definitely thank him for coming on the show. And we had some technical difficulties. So in the future, if I'm able to get him back on to kind of finish up the rest of the interview, I definitely would love to do that. So once again, this is Corey Washington for the Jimi Hendrix Black Legacy Series signing off. Thank you for listening.